The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hi. I think everybody's starting to come together here. I'm Conrad Martin. I'm Executive Director of the Fund for Constitutional Government. Is it on? Can you hear me? That sounds better. I'm Conrad Martin. I'm Executive Director of the Fund for Constitutional Government and also Executive Director of the Stuart Mott Charitable Trust. And I wanted to thank GAP and thank Mark and thank a lot of you here for having this in honor of Stuart Mott, who passed away on June 12th. Stuart really would have liked the fact that this kind of a panel has been designated in his name. If any of you read the obituaries about Stuart, you saw he was a creative philanthropist. He worked in a lot of different areas. And one of the things that really became a hallmark of our funding, of his funding, was working on whistleblower protection, was working on information policy broadly. And the reason that it became so important was that every issue area that we work on, it's linked by free speech, it's linked by no more in our name without our knowledge, and it's linked by the work that so many of you do in this room. So he really would have been honored, and I think that it's good to be here and to be able to do this in his name. We have a great panel to speak to this issue. Each has a very different perspective. When we would meet in the Fund for Constitutional Government board meetings, we would talk about what has become in part a constitution-free zone. A way in which these issues are treated where due process does not apply, where the Constitution is not enacted. And in these times where we are looking at global, what's going on globally, instead of being the kind of bellwether in terms of due process and constitutional law, we are instead really beginning to undermine the principles that has made this country great and has been a beacon for how we can handle these sorts of problems in the future. So you have the introductory notes. I'm not going to introduce each of the panelists. They're going to each take 10 minutes, between 5 and 10 minutes, give you an overview from their perspective, then spend a few minutes on prescriptive measures. And we've been able to, I object when I hear the term the pendulum is going to swing back. The pendulum has never swung back. The pendulum has been grabbed, pulled back, and has been through work, people in this room, people on this panel, that's going to happen. So what sort of opportunities we have for a reform Congress that's coming up, we're going to spend the last half an hour that we will have really on prescriptive measures and have a dialogue with the audience. So we're going to start with Danielle Bryan and then move through the panel.
Is it all right for me to stay sitting? Is that, there's filming, is that okay? Thanks, Mark. Welcome. That was a fabulous lunch talk. I thought it was really terrific. And one of the things I realized when Babak mentioned the crazies with Area 51, actually Pogo were the crazies with regards to Area 51. And that was actually a really illustrative national security example of the question that I'm going to be posing, which is, what do you do when you know something that involves illegality that is based on classified information? There is essentially no good option for a person who is in that situation. In that particular case, we had a widow of a person who worked at Area 51 who had died because he was working at these open-air pits where the Air Force was actually using those pits to burn toxic materials that were part of the construction of the stealth fighter out in California, and California environmental laws prevented them from burning those or destroying those materials in California, so they shipped them overnight to Nevada and were burning them in Area 51 and were hiding, using the secrecy of that facility to hide the fact that they were violating environmental law. But it took a lawsuit that went all the way up to the Supreme Court to try to fight what was essentially not, in fact, legitimately in any way, a national security concern. It was an environmental law that was being broken, but the government was hiding behind that illegality under the rules of national security. So one of the things that I I heard was discussed or mentioned earlier this morning that I wanted to make sure people understood. When my organization, the Project on Government Oversight, was created 27 years ago, we were the Project on Military Procurement. And the reason we were created was because of insiders in the Pentagon who were concerned about essentially various forms of corruption or illegality in the Pentagon. But they knew if they came out with this information that they would suffer the retaliation that you're fully aware of. But this was 27 years ago. So this is not a new problem. This is not limited to the Bush administration. This has been a growing trend, as Conrad was describing. The pendulum hasn't swung back. It keeps going in the same direction. But it started a long time ago. And so the question I wanted to pose, essentially, for the panelists and the audience to discuss is, what do you do when you are aware of national security information, particularly classified information? Where do you go? So if you're in the military or in one of the national security agencies or companies, and you go up the chain of command, generally that's going to be an unsatisfactory solution. So you either are going to be ignored or worse. So then what do? The Congress thinks the answer is you go to the Inspector General of those agencies. But POGO's been doing a lot of work with inspectors general, and the interesting thing there is they don't necessarily think that's their job to deal with whistleblowers with national security information. So there's an incredible disconnect that we're discovering between what the Congress thinks is supposed to happen to these national security whistleblowers and what those recipients, supposed recipients, the IGs, who don't really think it's necessarily their job to listen to these people, number one. So that's one of the problems. Congress. So if you go directly to Congress, who in Congress are you supposed to go to? And this is where Lou is, I think, going to be terrifically helpful in discussing this. Most whistleblowers aren't experts in being whistleblowers. You're accidental whistleblowers. You fall into this. It's not something you've studied. You don't have a roadmap. So how do you know which member of Congress? You assume if you live in Maryland, then you go to your senator. But if your senator isn't on the appropriate committee, it turns out that's not who you're supposed to go to. So it's not actually necessarily adequately protected, although I totally disagree with that philosophy, but many in Congress accept that philosophy, which is a huge problem. Many staff, even on the committees of jurisdiction, don't have adequate clearance. We had a case where there was an NSA whistleblower who was going to the, let's get this right, he was going to the House Intelligence Committee, and the letter went back to him that there was no one on this, because what he had to discuss was a special access program. There was no one on the House Intelligence Committee who had clearance, nor are there members of Congress who had clearance adequate to hear what this gentleman had to say. And Congressman Shays, in that case, who was not on the committee, was outraged at the concept that bureaucrats at an agency could conclude that a member of Congress, any member of Congress, doesn't have clearance to hear anything that a not super senior person at the NSA had to say. So I think that's an incredibly important issue that, as all of you rewrite laws in the future, really working on is Congress's ability to have complete access to information going on at the agencies. I think that's a central issue. So in the end, when you have a Congress that's currently kind of mealy-mouthed about how much information it can accept, where does that whistleblower go? And our conclusion is that you go to organizations like the ACLU or GAP or POGO that will help these people find the right channels in a more protected way, or the media. But the media, again, is this gigantic problem because their job isn't necessarily going to be to protect the whistleblower. So I think we're left with a really very compromised place for national security whistleblowers that is totally inadequate. And the information that those whistleblowers have is, of course, some of the most important information the whistleblower can have. So I'm going to stop now and throw it out for my colleagues.
Just quickly, Danielle Bryan is the executive director of the Project on Government Oversight.
Oh,
and
sorry.
And I encourage you all to go to her webpage and to take a look at the IG report, among many of the other reports that POGO has done recently. They are extraordinary, and it is worth a look.
Thank you.
And now we're going to move to Lou, who, if you would introduce yourself a little at the beginning here.
Well, I've been at Library of Congress, came in 1970, was with Congressional Research Service for 36 years, last 2.5 years with the Law Library. I've always done constitutional disputes among the three branches, locked on national security and war powers and state secrets privilege. I'm glad Danielle is here. Had a certain thing happen at the Library of Congress, POGO and GAP and other institutions came to my defense, and I landed on my feet, which is a lot better than landing somewhere else. So thank you all. We've been asked to sort of flag some problems in the national security area and indicate some solutions. And I think around the country and even at this conference, there's a certain temptation to believe that the problems we're in now are started with George W. Bush. I think the problem we're in right now have been going on, I would say, for a half century. All of us have been digging a hole, public and private, and unless we get serious, we'll never get out of the hole. It's not a matter of who is in the White House. I'll start with the courts. I don't know how often I'm around federal judges who will say we have no competence and authority in the field of national security. And I said, you used to, if you know something about your history, because I think I've read every war power national security case at the Supreme Court and lower court level, and courts never ducked those cases. They took them, the legal constitutional issue, they decided for or against the president, depending. The only times I know where courts ducked a national security issue were two cases after the Civil War during the Reconstruction period, ducked them probably for good reasons. But otherwise, they were handled like any other case. There's nothing in the Constitution that says courts can't decide national security cases. Preposterous. So at least up through the steel seizure case of 52, courts handled these things right in the middle of a Korean War. And I think what judges today remember, since they don't know anything about their own institution, they remember the Vietnam years where courts regularly duck war power cases. They tell people you don't have standing, or it's moot, or it's not right, or it's a political question, or there are prudential considerations, or equitable discretion, everything. That was at one period of probably 15 or so years of courts ducking cases. And I want to end on the Bamidian case. And I'll get to that the last point, if you think the courts have found their way. I don't think quite yet. Role of Congress. In the year 2000, before George W. Bush ever showed up as White House, I wrote a book called Congressional Abdication on War and Spending. What are your two core prerogatives in Congress, war and spending? And they've been pushing those powers away, sometimes not protecting themselves, sometimes voluntarily giving them away. It's been going on a long time, and as I say in my book, it started, I think, with Truman going to war on his own initiative, never coming to Congress in Korea in 1950. And from then on, either because of the fear of communism abroad or today the fear of Al-Qaeda abroad, Congress has not been doing its work. Big problem. How do you reverse that? Something for us to think about. Scholarly support. Scholars, I think, over that same period of time, the last 50 years, have been championing presidential power as the fountain of wisdom, the fountain of expertise, the fountain of understanding. Whoever gets in there has a national interest in mind, whereas Congress, you know, they have the local interest in mind and all of that. So when Truman went to war, major scholars defended what he did. Arthur Schlesinger, Henry Steele Commager, they said he had plenty of power, and they derided anyone who raised any constitutional issues. Well, by the mid-1960s, with the Vietnam War, suddenly Schlesinger and Commager swinging around said, we made a mistake in 1950. Well, it's a little bit late, you know, 15 years later to say you made a mistake. So scholars have been championing presidential power, having no understanding or care about checks and balances or separation of powers. Then you have to ask yourself in law schools, what kind of a job do you do? When you teach national security classes, do you teach it pretty much with the president having almost unilateral control? So it's a deep problem. Historians, political scientists, Richard Neustadt is a political scientist. His book on presidential power, there's not a word in there about law or constitution. And Neustadt argued that the more power the president has, the safer the country is. That's what we've been taught. Media. Just one silly example. 1995, New York Times on the front page above the fold, kept saying that Clinton doesn't need authority from Congress to send troops to Bosnia. So I wrote to the reporter, I said, why do you say that? You're not an expert. At least I've written this area. I think he does need authority. But why don't you say what is true, that the White House claims he doesn't need authority from Congress, or President Clinton argues he doesn't. So maybe 3 days later, I go out to the driveway, pick up the New York Times, and on the front page, another story like that above the fold, where the reporter is saying the White House argues that President Clinton doesn't need authority from Congress. So there are not too many nice things happen, but that was a nice thing. I go to work, and I either read the Hill, I think it was the Hill newspaper. In the past, they had opposed sending troops to Bosnia. But now, in an editorial, they said, although we continue to oppose U.S. troops to Bosnia under the Constitution, President Clinton doesn't need authority from Congress. So I called them. I said, why did you say that? They said it was in the New York Times. So people knowing nothing, no study, nothing, coming out and miseducating tens of millions of people. Let me end with this Bermudian case. Just two things of institutional interest. Justice Kennedy, having pointed to the problems of the procedures in Guantanamo, talks about the problems of an individual who is labeled as an enemy combatant not being able to get access to information, classified information held against him, questions as to whether even the attorney can get access to classified information, questions about whether information obtained through coercive methods can be used against the individual. So I'll just read what Kennedy says. We make no attempt to anticipate all of the evidentiary and access to counsel issues that will arise during the course of the detainee's habeas corpus proceedings. We recognize, however, that the government has a legitimate interest in protecting sources and methods, sources and methods of intelligence gathering, and we expect that the district court will use its discretion to accommodate this interest to the greatest extent possible. Confer United States against Reynolds, the state secrets case of 1953, and then parentheses, recognizing an evidentiary privilege in the civil damages case, the tort claims case, where, quote, there is a reasonable danger that compulsion of the evidence will expose military matters which, in the interest of national security, should not be divulged. This just dropped in there. I have no idea why it's dropped in. But it's a civil damages case. What does the civil damages tort claims case has to do with a person in Guantanamo who is being charged as enemy combatant and faces a death penalty? There's no connection here. And on that same page, Kennedy drops in this. In considering both the procedural and substantive standards used to impose detention to prevent acts of terrorism, proper deference must be accorded to the political branches. C, United States against Curtis Wright, 299 U.S. 304, 320, 1936. You'd have to take the time. The Curtis Wright is one of the silliest. It's all dicta in the past, and 320 is dicta. But here is a Supreme Court case that rejects the notion that the president, and even in concert with Congress, has any kind of unchecked power to do what they're doing in Guantanamo. So if you look at page 320 in Curtis Wright, what does it say? The very delicate, plenary, and exclusive power of the president as a sole organ, a silly thing, sole organ of the federal government in the field of international relations, the power which does not require as a basis for its exercise an act of Congress. So here's the court, on the one hand, putting on some constraints on the two political branches, on the other hand, with this kind of stuff at the back, throwing it away. So we have very little understanding, comprehension of basic constitutional values of checks and balances. And we better start learning. Thanks.
Thank you, Lou. We're going to move next to Stephen Cohen, the president of the National Whistleblower Center.
Well, thank you very much. I want to thank the Washington College of Law and the Government Accountability Project for organizing this spectacular conference. I got my start in whistleblowing as an intern, later a lawyer, with the Government Accountability Project, and I know they've done spectacular work over the years, and I'm very happy that they're calling attention to the national security issues. Everyone knows that whistleblowers have some issues, and I am actually a time traveler. And this is true. I actually traveled in time and got to see Congress pretty much unanimously pass a law guaranteeing every whistleblower the right to go to Congress and blow the whistle on any issue, including top secret national security, and to protect them in that right. I got to see it. I was only traveling to 1791 when the First Amendment was passed. In 1993, at the time of the first World Trade Center case, I had the honor of representing my first national security whistleblower. His job was to secure the crime scene after the terrorist attack that luckily did not bring those towers down. He had the most top secret clearances conceivable. The clearances were so top secret that he was not allowed to tell me what the clearances were. Then, who knows? The day that we started representing him, a letter comes in from the Attorney General's office saying that this whistleblower, Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, cannot talk to us unless anything and everything he says is cleared by the Justice Department before he talks to us, because he's all confidential. And I do not have a clearance and never will have a clearance. Not because, I just won't apply for it. Well, whatever Dr. Whitehurst said to us after that day is and remains attorney-client privilege, so I can't confirm whether he said a word or not. The next thing that occurs is they want him to sign a confession because they think he may have done an unauthorized disclosure to Congress. Now, remember, 1791, I thought that was fixed, but they didn't. And they had typed up a confession. They had put him under a criminal investigation for this suspicion. And he said, I'd like to talk to my lawyers before I sign the confession. They said, no, the confession is an open government document, not confirmed yet. You have to sign it. We clear it, and then you can show it to your lawyers. Wow. So Dr. Whitehurst calls us up from the interrogation chamber itself. I don't know if he had a cell phone or someone was nice enough. He got one call, and he said, what should I do? And we said, Fred, don't sign it. And they said, Dr. Whitehurst, if you don't sign that, we can take your gun, we can strip you of your classification, and we can throw you out the door. It's insubordination, and you've got clearances. You're ordered to sign it. You can make a change, sign it, and then talk to your lawyer. Fred said no. He got up and walked out. I believe, and that all happened very early in 93, I believe it was the turning point of the case. Not so much because the FBI didn't quite know how to handle it, but because there were old-time journalists from the who covered the Justice Department for years, and they all knew of these crazy procedures. And they knew that, and they never heard of anyone ever saying no. So his credibility just rose. They loved the guy. He's the guy that wouldn't sign it. Well, things were getting tough. So the next thing is we decide we'll go for a meeting on the Hill. So we bring Dr. Whitehurst up, and just you have to see him. He's about 6'2". He's a three-term veteran from Vietnam, crew cut, American flag lapel. He is would be considered in the FBI what's known as a blue flamer, someone who's going to head right to the top. The guy is solid, a lot of respect. He walks in there with Congressman John Conyers' staff, and they couldn't quite figure this guy out because he did not look like, a whistleblower or probably anyone who's ever walked into the office before except for perhaps serve papers or something. And they said, Dr. Whitehurst, what do you got to say? He says, I got nothing to say. I can't say it. They say, I can't talk to you. Well, why are you here? Well, there's something big going on. Can you tell us what case it relates to? I'm not allowed to, but you know there's a big case going on, and I'm the number one explosives expert. Are you talking about that case in New York? I can't say anything. Okay, bye. So we're out. I get a call 2 days later from someone from Congressman Conyers' office, very nice staffer, said, listen, there's going to be a routine audit of the crime lab, that's where he worked, and just tell Fred he can talk to the auditor. Okay, that's all we needed. And he spoke to the auditor, and he wrote up a memo or two, and in a couple weeks I get a call from the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York saying, we need Dr. Whitehurst up in New York at the World Trade Center trial, in the middle of the trial of the defendants, because he has exculpatory evidence under Brady, and the judge has ordered he be made available to the defendants. Interesting footnote. So Dr. Whitehurst can tell suspected terrorists responsible for blowing up or attempting to blow up the World Trade Center all his secrets, and I'm not even allowed to know them or Congressman Conyers. Interesting footnote. Anyway, we go along with the game. We show up, and the prosecuting attorney, a very nice gentleman, says, okay, talk to the defendants. I say, well, he can't talk to the defendants. Well, the judge ordered. I said, no, because I'm his lawyer. I have to advise him. He can't talk to me. I can't give him advice. So therefore, he can't talk. Well, the judge said he's got to talk. Well, so it's now 10 p.m. at night. It was a day that they shut Washington, D.C. down because it got too cold. 1993, you can look it up in the calendar. We can know the exact date. D.C. shut down. And we call the general counsel of the FBI. We get him at home. And he says, permission granted to talk to counsel. I said, well, that's just spectacular, but you got to put it in writing. This is too important. Well, I'm at home and I don't have a secretary. We'll wait. So he drove into Washington, faxed us the letter, and then on that day, in February 1993, the FBI gave Dr. Whitehurst permission in writing to speak to counsel with no security clearance about anything and every allegation he had about misconduct in, at that time, perhaps the most important international terrorist case going on in the United States, World Trade Center 1. So within the confines of this crazy world, just as though where it kind of ended up, it ended up at Oklahoma City bombing, another major domestic terrorism case. By this time, not only did he have permission to talk to us, but he had permission while still active duty with the FBI, while still a supervising special agent, he had gotten permission to talk to ABC News, Larry King Live, CNN. We could just sit meet with the defendants for 2 weeks going over evidence. Essentially, the First Amendment as the wedge, the Constitution as the second hit, and the power of what I would say the truth, and it might sound corny, but if you have information which the American people have a need to know, and if you can find an avenue to move it, even within the confines of national security, I do believe change can occur and information can get out. Eventually, the interesting part of the case is, although there was no quote-unquote law protecting him, although there was the First Amendment and some other procedures, Privacy Act, etc., they were required to settle that case, and Dr. Whitehurst did very well. And that is my perspective on national security whistleblowing. The cases are very hard. Sometimes you're going to lose because sometimes they're just going to get you. But you can win, you can push it, and you can have an element of success. Because ultimately, we do live in a democratic society. And ultimately, Congress and the public have an absolute need to know certain information. And it may not be easy, and it may take years. But it can be pushed. I was asked to briefly address my perspective on what should happen. And here's another thing that most people don't know. Yes, national security whistleblowers have been stripped of their rights, theoretically, as whistleblowers. And I mean by theoretically, the Constitution is the override. But they have no whistleblower rights per se. They were excluded from the Whistleblower Protection Act. However, whistleblowers, or excuse me, all employees in these secret agencies are protected under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Prohibition on discrimination of race, sex, religion, national origin. So, for example, today I'm able to represent a Mr. Bassem Youssef, who's currently involved as the unit chief in the counterterrorism division. Again, he has clearances that are unbelievable. He's a great guy. He also has major responsibilities both for the National Security Letter Program, for which the abuses have been well documented, and he's blown the whistle on that. He also has responsibilities for the what's known as the Special Project. And he was never able to tell me and never told me what the Special Project was until the Inspector General's office wanted to question him, and they told me what it was, which is the National Security Agency's Domestic Spying Program. So although he has this responsibilities, under Title VII as an Arab American, he has rights. And the same goes for other persons within national security. And so it's our perspective that by taking the rights national security whistleblowers already have under Title VII and expanding them to cover whistleblowers, we will achieve significant reform. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Stephen.
I just want to add one thing to what you said, Steve. When you list the things that are essential as a national security whistleblower, you also have to have a really gutsy lawyer like you to do it. And that's really, it's an important, you're being modest, but you have to have the guts that Steve has or his colleagues. It's an essential part for national security whistleblowers to succeed.
And we're going to come back to that on prescriptive measures, too. Mike German, please.
Hi, my name's Mike German. I'm a policy counsel for the American Civil Liberties Union. I'm different from everybody else on the panel because all of them chose to be an advocate for whistleblowers, and I'm sort of an advocate for whistleblowers by happenstance. I was an FBI agent for 16 years, working mostly domestic terrorism issues. And shortly after 9/11, I was asked to assist in an investigation that involved a supporter of an Islamic terrorist group recruiting a white supremacist, leader of a white supremacist organization to join forces operationally in furtherance of their shared hatred of Jews to accomplish things together. And it's kind of been reported in the media sometimes that I discovered this alliance, but actually that's not quite correct. I was literally asked to help after the FBI had already initiated an investigation based on the fact that this meeting, by pure luck, an FBI informant had been involved and had recorded this meeting. So it seemed to me, shortly after 9/11, and as Colleen Rowley said, you know, that the FBI was clearly moving into this sort of profiling type mode, that it would certainly help them to understand that people who perhaps would not fit the profile may in fact be trying to assist foreign terrorists in accomplishing their goals, that this would be a very significant investigation. Unfortunately, when I came down to Florida to help in their case, what I found was that it was just a mess. And having been through a number of terrorism prosecutions, I knew how difficult it was because there are good lawyers out there who make every mistake the FBI agent makes quite costly to the prosecution. So I knew how these mistakes were really going to impact prosecution, and I wanted to make sure that the FBI got the mistakes addressed right away. So I thought it was my obligation to report it through the chain of command. And at the time, I was quite hopeful that it would make a difference because, of course, this was after 9/11. It was shortly after Colleen Rowley's letter had gone public, And the FBI director, in fact, the President of the United States, had both come out and said, if there is a federal agent out there who knows of a problem in a terrorism case, we want to know the information, and we will protect you. That was the first time I found out the FBI sometimes lies. and it was a very simple thing because, again, this meeting had been recorded. So there was, you know, physical evidence that suggested it happened. And I was shocked when I found out shortly after I had reported it and about three months of sort of ongoing retaliation for this. Finally, somebody at the IG's office who I had reported to, but they would not open a case. But he called me up and he said, I thought you said you had a transcript of this meeting. And I said, I do. And he said, well, I need you to go in the computer and read this one memo. And when I read it, what I found out was they were denying that the meeting happened, the FBI and official records. And I was shocked by that, but then it sort of made sense to me, the retaliation that I was feeling, that, okay, they have one agent who said this happened and a bunch of supervisors saying it didn't. So I flew up to Washington and dropped the transcript on the desk, and it was interesting because you had these IG investigators and FBI OPR investigators, and they wouldn't look at it. You know, and I'm going, guys, it's not going to go away just because you don't look at it. But what I didn't realize is that it would, and it went away for 4 years. And that's one of the things that's most frustrating to me as now an advocate on the outside, when I hear people talk about providing whistleblower protection for people in the national security agencies, because it's about protecting the secrets and keeping the secrets secret, and that will keep us safe, when in fact there's really no basis for that at all. That this idea that secrecy protects our national security, if you look through history, you'll see that most often it doesn't, that the secrecy actually adversely affects our national security. You just have to look at the 9/11 Commission report to find that out, that it was agents and agencies protecting their information and not sharing their information that led to the failures of 9/11. And, you know, rather than address those management failures and the excessive secrecy that surrounds the national security and still negatively impacts our security, you know, we've given these agencies more authority, more money, and less accountability. And where else in your life do those three things combine into a more effective system? It's actually a less effective system, because inside this closed system, it's a lot easier to blind yourself to the truth. And, you know, after 9/11, it became very commonplace to hear that this is going to be an intelligence war, that intelligence is going to be critical. Well, it's critical to know what intelligence is. And nobody seems to be able to answer that question. And I thought it was best answered by James Pavitt, who was the former CIA Director of Operations. He retired in 2004. And in defending the intelligence agencies, this was just when the failure of analysis of the Iraq weapons of mass destruction intelligence in Iraq was coming out. He said, well, the American public expects too much from the intelligence community. He said, intelligence can only be correct 40% to 50% of the time, which means that we could trade in this multi-billion-dollar intelligence community for a quarter and at least be at the top end of the product he was planning on putting out. And the one thing to recognize about that is that, you know, if 50% of the intelligence is wrong, wrong intelligence is worse than no intelligence, because that will lead you to make decisions based on an error rather than trying to make the best decision with no information. And you'd be shocked, as I was, at how the intelligence community was so willing to blind itself to this event. And I'll use the facts of my case to make the point. A little more than a year after I had reported to the IG what had happened in this case, and after they knew of all the retaliation and knew, you know, that they had made false statements, they finally opened an investigation that was completed a year and a half after I resigned from the FBI in protest for their not having done an investigation. And their report, which, you know, most IG reports are available online so you could read them, this one isn't, which in the investigative biz we used to call a clue. The IG said that the FBI backdated and falsified records, that the FBI failed to properly investigate my allegations, that the FBI retaliated against me for reporting this matter. But they agreed with the FBI's conclusion, based on the FBI's analysis, that this meeting involved no discussion of terrorism. And when the report was given to me, I told the investigators from the IG that I was going to go public with it. And they got very upset about that. And I got on the phone with the general counsel, and he said, okay, look, if you go public, you have to make sure and never say the name of the two terrorist groups involved. And, you know, you are forbidden from saying the. And I said, okay, let me get this straight. I am forbidden from naming the two terrorist groups your report says are not involved in the case. You know, how does this even make sense? But again, it's that willful blindness. I was very fortunate that I had a champion in Senator Charles Grassley from Iowa, and he and his dogged investigative team led by Jason Foster fought for 2 years to finally get the transcript out of the hands of the FBI. And when the Senator Grassley's office got it, there was an FBI oversight hearing that Director Mueller was testifying in. And again, the IG has said that they agreed with the FBI's conclusion that there was no terrorism discussed based on the great investigative work the FBI's investigators had determined. So here's what Senator Grassley said. After years of effort by this committee, the FBI finally provided a transcript of the meeting, and it flatly contradicts statements made by Bureau officials trying to downplay the incidents and discredit Michael German. The transcript clearly shows a white supremacist and an Islamic militant talking about building operational ties between their organizations. Moreover, it is clear that what brings them together is anti-Semitism. According to the transcript, these two groups discussed, one, shooting Jews, two, their shared admiration of Hitler, three, arms shipments from Iran, four, their desire for a civil war in the United States, five, their approval for suicide bombings, and six, assassinating pro-Israeli journalists in the United States. He then asked Director Mueller if he had read the transcript and whether he had provided it to the intelligence community. And Mueller said he had not read the transcript and did not know if it had been provided to the intelligence community. And he said, well, if it says this, why not? And he said, because the IG had determined that no terrorism was discussed on the transcript. So, you know, within the intelligence community, there is not just what they don't know, it's that in a closed system, you can actually blind yourself to what is true. And when it serves the interests of your agency, that's easier to do than when it serves the public interest in knowing this information and even the intelligence community in knowing what the true threats are. So, you know, when people talk about national security and say that whistleblowers would harm the national security, it's actually the opposite. That typically what they're reporting is failures in the operations of what's happening that is actually harming our national security. And, you know, if in the 9/11 case, there was an agent from New York who was forbidden to access the information about Khalid al-Midar and Nawaf al-Hamzi coming to the United States. And he actually sent an email to headquarters saying people are going to die because of this decision. Right? In the Massawi case, you had an FBI supervisor being criticized for repeatedly bringing up that we have to investigate this. And he said, I'm trying to stop somebody from flying a plane into the World Trade Center. Literally said that. It's in the 9/11 Commission report. Now, if these people had been able to report that information outside the chain of command, you know, perhaps something could have been done. But again, these agencies are interested in protecting their prerogatives first and the national security second, and that's why we need to have mechanism for agents and employees of the government to report where there are problems. And, you know, the only way our checks and balances that Lou talked about can work is if people can get true information. But if the FBI and the other intelligence agencies are willing to lie to Congress, it's going to take honest employees coming forward. And unless we protect them, they can't.
Thanks, Mike.
Our last panelist is Ann Beeson, now with the Open Society Institute. Ann, please.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. Just so that my remarks will make a little sense, I'll also mention that before moving to OSI, I was a lawyer with the ACLU, where I had the privilege of representing a number of national security whistleblowers. So I want to just build on a couple of the remarks made by the other panelists, and first to just emphasize a point that both Lou and Steve made about how it would be a dangerous mistake on our part as advocates for more transparency to think that these issues are only issues of the last administration and not much deeper problems with the kind of balance of powers over the last several decades, frankly. And actually, just to sort of emphasize that point, I wanted to share a little historical anecdote, which is that I was actually first made aware of the state secrets privilege, which, as you know, has been one of the government's most powerful tools against not just national security whistleblowers, but a range of other challenges to executive abuses. It was actually Dan Ellsberg himself, the rock star of national security whistleblowers, that first told me about the state secrets privilege. And I was hanging out at an unnamed bar in California with Dan Ellsberg and Colleen Rowley, and they were talking about how little had changed in the kind of, 30 years since Dan had kind of, done the unspeakable and exposed the Pentagon Papers. So that just goes to show you, again, just how far back these challenges go. And Dan is out there still tirelessly advocating on behalf of other national whistleblowers and the need to sort of speak truth to power. I wanted to just to actually sort of inject into the dialogue, the conversation, a question about irrationality. Now, maybe this isn't a positive, constructive way to move things, but I feel that it's important to understand just how irrational the kind of public policy on this set of issues is in a couple of different ways. And first, just and again, this builds kind of on Mike's remarks. First, and Danielle's remarks, just to sort of just think for a second about just how irrational it is that, especially in a country so obsessed with national security, it would be national security whistleblowers who would have no protection. I mean, think about that. Like, if you were going to have any single category of government employees that you would think would have special protection, increased protection, to bring to the public's attention abuses, it would be national security whistleblowers. So just reflect on that for a minute. And also, again, not just that they lack protection, but they are the most retaliated against. I mean, maybe I can't prove that. You guys on the rest of the panel might be able to prove. But, very frequently at the top of the list in terms of the kinds of government employees who are most frequently retaliated against for speaking out. And, again, you would think that those agencies in particular would understand the importance of treating seriously any claim of abuse or illegality. I mean, to sort of put it another, and what I found so remarkable in having the honor to represent national security whistleblowers is, these are just the kind of people we want working for the federal government. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I want Mike German working for the FBI, And again, just, that these would be the category of sort of employees and government agents who would be, treated so poorly and so abused by their own government. So the other kind of irrationality that I wanted to just sort of talk about for a minute that really has, I was a little stunned by in representing a number of individuals, was just the how powerful what I have called in some context the secrecy Trump is, especially with courts and also with Congress. And again, others on the panel could speak more to Congress. But you have judges who, in many other contexts, even other national security contexts, can sometimes be sort of quite rational and kind of do their duty to exercise strong oversight as judges. But you get the government come in and claim something like the state secrets privilege, or you know, impose a gag on lawyers and clients in a case, and suddenly, like, their reasoning skills are sort of thrown out the window. And it's really sort of more accurate to think of it like, you know, secrecy Kool-Aid. I mean, you know, it's kind of like they've drunk the secrecy Kool-Aid. And just to give a couple of examples, and, you know, they, unfortunately, it makes us laugh. I mean, Mike, they make us laugh, Stephen. But these are, but, you know, they're not funny. I mean, so just to give, to throw a couple more in the mix, just for the sake of conversation and Q&A in a minute, and a prescriptive agenda, which I have a long list of, and I know Conrad is going to get us into that in a minute. The first time I saw, one of the early times that I saw this was in a case. You know, again, you wouldn't necessarily call these people whistleblowers, but they were. This is a, this was a challenge to the national security letter provision of the Patriot Act. This was the summer that everyone was, that Ashcroft himself was out there trying to build support for renewing the Patriot Act provisions, including the national security letter provision of the Patriot Act, which allowed the government to get a broad new range of personal records about all of us. And they had been going, you know, Ashcroft and his buddies had been going around telling everybody that, that, you know, the civil libertarians were sort of hysterical for saying that the power had been abused. And in particular, those librarians, boy, were they hysterical to suggest that, like, the power could ever be used to obtain library records on behalf of any sort of ordinary person. Well, in the middle of that kind of national debate, this is when I was at the ACLU, we got a call from, guess what? A group of librarians in Connecticut who had received a national security letter. And what they wanted to do, of course, was to immediately go out and tell the world not the details about the national security letter and the information that it demanded about a supposed terrorism suspect, you know, but just to tell the world that they had received such a national security letter so that they could prove that Ashcroft's claim that these kinds of records weren't at risk was totally false. And they were, you know, prevented from even doing so, from even identifying the fact that they had gotten one of these letters, that they were librarians in Connecticut that wanted to sort of speak out. And they, and you know, the case was wacky enough, and we weren't even able to disclose the existence of the lawsuit being filed until several weeks after it was filed, because we were in negotiations with the government. But then, you know, in the middle of the case, and we won it at the trial court level, and she, you know, she ruled against the government on the gag order that had been imposed on the librarians and on the lawyers, including myself. And then it was up on appeal, and in the middle of it being up on appeal, this kind of industrious New York Times reporter figured out who our clients were. She did a little bit of research, and she figured it out. It turned out that the government itself had forgotten to redact the name of our clients in a number of public court records. We hadn't even noticed this, but she figured it out. And so she publishes in the New York Times the name of our clients, you know. And then the Washington Post and all sorts of other, you know, they publish it too, and it's all over the place. So we think, okay, well, so this is easy. Now they'll drop it. Now they'll drop the gag on our librarians from being able to sort of speak out about the Patriot Act. No, no, no. They did not drop it at all. And we had to go all the way to the Supreme Court, and we had to file all of those briefs under seal because the government made us file those briefs under seal. And the phrases throughout our brief that said the cat is out of the bag, the genie is out of the bottle, were redacted one by one throughout the brief. I mean, you know, and again, it's just, it's remarkable to me that this actually happened, and even more remarkable that the Supreme Court ruled against us. Now, this was an emergency stay motion, and we won't get into all the procedural details. I mean, it was an extraordinary motion that we filed, but we felt that it was an extraordinary thing, and we thought we had a strong First Amendment here in this country. Well, it turns out we don't. Ultimately, of course, 2 weeks after the Patriot Act was reauthorized, with some fixes, a few fixes, I think due in large part to the courage of people like our librarians, but with a gag order that was still unconstitutional. 2 weeks after the legislation was passed, guess what? We get a little call from our friends that are the lawyers for the FBI, and they say, we've decided to drop the gag order against the librarians. 2 weeks after the new law is passed. So reach your own conclusions there. The second one that I wanted to mention was a case that I was involved in on behalf of Sybelle Edmonds, another kind of brave FBI whistleblower. And this is one of the cases where the government came in and filed the state secrets privilege to dismiss a case that she had brought against the FBI for retaliating against her for her whistleblowing. She had been a translator in the translation unit in the FBI that was responsible for translating wiretaps and terrorism cases, including the 9/11 attacks. And she had exposed potential espionage and other wrongdoing inside that unit and was fired for it again. And we had filed this lawsuit and were just stunned when the government came in and filed the state secrets privilege. And so that was kind of wacky enough because there was, again, it's a little bit of a legal technicality, which I'm happy to answer questions about if you have it, but you know, there was nothing remotely close to state secrets at issue in the case. The only question in a retaliation case like that is whether or not the FBI fired her for speaking out. I mean, whether or not what she was saying was true was irrelevant, right? And, in fact, the Inspector General, in the course of the lawsuit, wrote a report which confirmed, like in the Inspector General's report, that the FBI had, in fact, fired her for speaking out. So we already had the Inspector General saying that the one piece of proof that we needed to win our case, you know, was accurate, right? District Court dismisses the case. We take it up on appeal. So that was wacky enough. But then, you know, the day before the Court of Appeals here in D.C. was set to hear her case, we get this sort of one-line order from the panel, saying that they're going to close the courtroom for the entire hearing. Okay, now the government hadn't even asked. The government itself did not ask to close the hearing. And, of course, that's because, you know, as is typical in a case like that, we the lawyers, we didn't have a clue what secrets the government was telling the judges about. We didn't know anything. They had filed all of these secret affidavits to support their claim of state secrets. So especially with respect to my portion of the argument, there was literally no way I could expose any kind of a – I didn't know what the secrets were. I couldn't expose them. And yet, again, the judges themselves, without any, you know, due process at all or without any notification to the media, decided to close the courtroom. And this is a very high-profile case. Well, fortunately, we were able to rally the media, and they did, you know, and they came in. And they filed, of course, kind of an emergency motion to open the courtroom, which, again, at the beginning of the argument the next day, big surprise, the judges deny, right? And so we had this argument before the three-judge panel, before the three-judge panel, and, you know, I'm basically told by the judges that they're not really interested in hearing the argument, but our briefs were really good, which is always a first sign you've lost. That's like a rule to you law students out there. If the judge compliments your brief, you've lost. Just, that's it. So we get to the end of the argument, totally, you know, they've cleared the courtroom of hundreds of people, literally, that had come out to hear it. And I get to the end of it and I say, well, you know, Your Honors, you know, can I now go, there's a lot of press outside, can I now go outside and tell them what's just happened? And they say, oh, sure. They say, fine. Yeah, you can go out and tell them everything that's just happened, you know. So anyway, again, I wanted to say that we're dealing with, there's something about secrecy and there's something about national security that really makes even smart, rational policymakers kind of jump off the deep end or something. And we need to, I think, account for that. You know, we need to somehow grapple with that in setting an agenda for reform. So I'll stop there for now.
Thank you, Anne. We're going to move into question and answer. I just want to do two quick interjections here. The question of whether we take these things seriously or not is actually, I think, an important question. And I'll put that into a context that Clive Stanton Smith, who's representing 40 of the Guantanamo detainees, has written a book that is actually very funny about his stories. And he makes an argument that some of this is so absurd we should not take it seriously. That when you look at it at the face value of what's going on, they expect that we are to take it serious, and that the one thing he offers as an example, he goes to Guantanamo for the first time, and as he goes up, he's Australian, he has an absolutely brilliant wit. And they're standing there, and they say to him, they salute one another, and he's with the commanding officer to Guantanamo, and the person at the gate says, "Protecting freedom, sir." Standing in front of the most secure facility in the world, and he cracked up laughing. And they were close to arresting him. They were so pissed off at him, but they couldn't do anything about it. And he said, when you see these kinds of absurdities, you should respond to them as absurdities. That frankly, that is a part of what is in our arsenal. They expect you to engage on a very rational basis, and if it is, you do that. But you also begin by saying a lot of what we're discussing here is irrational. And I also commend to you, you can look in Harper's Magazine and read the exchange between Smith and the head of Guantanamo over the Armor All underwear that are found in his client's cells. I leave it at that. It is one of the most hysterical three letters you will ever read in your life. They accuse him of smuggling them in, and he takes it very seriously, said, and I did not, and then gives them a very strong argument why it wasn't him. Now, all of that said, I do want to move us to prescriptive measures, and one of the things that Mike said struck me, that closed systems blind you to what is what is true. And Theodore White, in In Search of History, wrote that McCarthyism poked the eyes out of U.S. foreign policy. And if you look at a lot of what he was mentioning there, people were disqualified from foreign service if they spoke the language of the areas in which they were assigned, because there was a communist scare. And they deselected from the best people. And I think that were very, very similar thing is happening here now in the name of national security, and that we really are poking our eyes out as we go forward. You know, so I'd like to begin, just prerogative of the moderator, with my first question to Lou. You know, if we look at when the pendulum has swung before, and I'm going to mention one of the things that Stuart Mott did. The Wall Street Journal, in their Saturday's issue, commended him as a liberal freedom fighter. I mean, they mourned him and said he was a liberal freedom fighter. And what they were talking about is that Stuart took out a full-page ad in the New York Times talking about President Nixon's involvement in the secret bombing of Cambodia. And Creep went after him that it was a political expenditure. Stuart did that because what he wanted to do was engender outrage. And at that time, there really was outrage. I mean, I think that if we looked at the response to COINTELPRO and people learned that we were wiretapping our own citizens, that the movement, the peace movement, and the Black Panther movement, and civil rights movement, Martin Luther King was being wiretapped, the response was outrage. We then had the Church Committee report, Otis Pike's report, that really came out and looked at all of these abuses, and FISA and many of the things now that have been rolled back by what we've seen were in response to that. So my question to Lou is kind of looking back and walking back the clock. I've been saying that the 1974 was referred to as the Reform Congress, and it came out of the unpopular war and real abuses of the executive that had taken place. We have a very similar constellation that's lining up now. But did Frank Church become the leader on it because he was pressured, or was Frank Church the leader? And where is today's Frank Church, and how do we get those kind of committees going in this next Congress?
I think we overstated. 1973-74 period was a reassertive Congress. Again, the press picked that up. Congress is reasserting itself. The Church Committee certainly got close to the bottom of a number of things. I think Church probably paid a political price for it. But if you look at other things happening during that same time, 1973 was the War Powers Resolution, which Tom Eagleton of Missouri was a sponsor on the Senate side. And it was a pretty strong bill. The weak bill came out of the House, and then when Eagleton saw what came out of the Conference Committee, he not only voted against it because it was giving away congressional power rather than protecting congressional power, he gave a long speech on the floor as to why it was a surrender. And when he finished the speech, one of his colleagues, a senator, came over and says, Tom, that was a great speech. I love the Constitution, but I hate Nixon more. And there was a senator willingly giving away his power because he had a short term. And if you remember what was going on that time, they wanted the desire to impeach Nixon was so great that members had no problem surrendering their power. So I don't look back at that period as a time when Congress either understood itself as an institution. That was about 4 years after I came to Congress. At that time, I certainly worked with a lot of members of the House and Senate who I think were what I call institutionalists, who cared about their institution, who understood a strong Congress as part of the checks and balance. I know very, very few members of Congress today who think about it that way. And I don't know how much of that is because they're spending a huge amount of the time simply raising money. I don't bring it up as an issue of corruption. They just don't have time to take care of themselves. I just wanted to say I have a book coming out in August, and my publisher and I left the subtitle ambiguous. Anyway, the title is The Constitution of 9/11. But the subtitle is Recurring Threats to America's Freedoms. And it's ambiguous. And a lot of people say, yeah, the threats from abroad, the threats from our enemies. And my book says, no, it's the threats from us. And since you're talking about that period, what everyone thinks about Joe McCarthy, well, long before Joe McCarthy was here, was Harry Truman, who in 1947 issued an executive order on the loyalty security boards, which means they could bring you into the agency with three of your colleagues. So you've been reading communist literature and you have communist friends. You say, that's not the case. What's the basis for that? Well, we have information. We have informers who say that. Who? We don't have to tell you. That was the way the executive order was set up. So in terms of blinding ourselves, we lost so many people in the Foreign Service and throughout government who were drummed out of public service. And, of course, the private service sector thought that was a great idea. The state and local governments did it. And private industry did it for engineers who had security clearances and were losing them. So in these times where there's a threat abroad, we typically overreact and do injury far greater than any enemy could ever think of.
Thanks. Let me open it up for questions. Not one. Yep.
My name is Aaron Reynolds. I want to thank the our sponsors, because one time when I was going in front of Judge Stanley Sporkin downtown, I raised a group of people from Gap to be an audience, and they were the only people who kept me from getting Rule 11 sanctions. My question to the panel is, that sort of thing can hit a lawyer unexpected. Do you have any prescription other than take a crowd with you?
I think in the context of national security, the courts themselves, the record is clear. You have to be careful when and how to use the courts. There are as many weapons available to defend a national security whistleblower, the press, Congress, the power of the disclosure itself and how that impacts the institution. The courts have been reluctant to intervene. And so I just say that, and almost implicitly, by stating that you are bringing a crowd with you to the courthouse, you are essentially breaking the mold of just looking to the courts to obtain the ruling you wanted. So that's our perspective on all national security whistleblowers. They're hard cases. You have to be very careful with them, but you can't sell yourself short and only think because you're a lawyer that your sole representation authority is in a courthouse, because the judges are reluctant. That's my perspective.
Anyone else want to?
Yes. James Manship. I'm a historian and a court reporter, and I appreciate Ms. Beeson speaking to the history. Some other things that history-wise, we are just a few weeks short of July 11th, and in 1958, that's when the Code of Ethics was passed by Charlie Bennett, or he introduced it. And that says any person in government service should put loyalty to the higher moral principle and to country above loyalty to government, persons, party, or department. And, point nine, expose corruption wherever discovered. Now, we have a few things from a historical standpoint. There was a cryptologist, and he detected spies on Pearl Harbor. He went outside of the intelligence chain of command and was relieved of his duties and ended World War II as an officer in charge of a dry dock in California. Joseph J. Rochefort, lieutenant commander. You had Ron Rosner report the My Lai massacre. You have the great whistleblower, Deep Throat, number two man in the FBI, afraid to come forth and identify who he is because of the damage to his profession, his career. And that's the situation that we have in the situation with whistleblowers. Now, another thing to just sort of put a little bit of humor to it is that Admiral Rickover, the guru of the nuclear navy, was quoted in a Republic of India press account on whistleblowers. And he says, if you're going to sin, sin against God, not the government, because God may forgive you, but the bureaucrats certainly never will. The reality is, as we talked in the earlier panel about judges, and judges are emasculating the laws that people here in this room are working for, and judges are not lifetime appointments. They're there on the occasion of good behavior. And judges who are rewriting the law are not exhibiting good behavior. We currently have a judge before the Judiciary Committee for impeachment. There have been 17 impeachments since the founding of the Republic. 11 of them have been judges, and 7 of them have been impeached, convicted, and removed from office. We have to protect our Constitution by impeachment of judges who violate these whistleblower laws. Any comments?
Thank you.
Yeah, I just wanted to make kind of two comments, one sort of moving towards the prescriptive, and while I think it's always great to have a spectrum of advocates, you know, advocating for reform rather than advocate for more impeachment, I want to advocate for another approach, which is lots more training for judges. That would be on the list because, you know, judges seem to think that they're incapable of or don't have the skills to handle sensitive information. The irony here is they do it all the time in the business context, right? They do it all the time when you're talking about, you know, sort of trade secrets, and suddenly they just get freaked out when it's sort of government secrets instead of, you know, corporate secrets. So, but training of judges would be a step in the right direction. The other thing, too, is there's been a lot of, there's been maybe more focus here on the panel around the lack of oversight on the part of judges than on Congress, and maybe we should hear a little bit more. Because I think it's just appalling the extent to which there has been so little congressional oversight. I mean, the irony about all the kind of post 9/11 abuses is, frankly, how little we still know. And again, just to remember, how do we know about Abu Ghraib? How do we know about the NSA surveillance program? How do we know about any of the major abuses? Every single one of those issues was disclosed by, guess what, a national security whistleblower. None of them, not a single one of the abuses that we think of as being so well established now, right, was exposed by Congress.
Right.
That is appalling. I mean, that's an appalling situation. And so there has to be, but you know, there has to also be training for members of Congress. And I mean, I know Danielle's group, I think, is even working on this, so maybe I'll just turn it over to her to say more about that. Yeah.
On the issue of Congress, it's so awful. It's breathtaking. About 5 years ago, I got a call from a friend of mine who worked for he was a senior staffer who worked for a House office, and he said, Danielle, I'm calling. I'm working on this FOIA request, and I need some help. And I said, well, the first thing you do is you put your pen down, because you work for the Congress. And the Congress is not supposed to be writing Freedom of Information Act requests. We have the god of FOIA over here.
FOIA.
I hope you agree with me on this. It was shocking that we then, over a couple of years, we planned and finally have started a year ago training for congressional staff on how to do oversight. And I blew up a House Judiciary.
Like a terrorist. You're blowing up something.
Oh, I mean big. Don't mean blow up.
Lord.
Oh my God. Big poster-sized a House Judiciary Committee letter, and I held it up to House staff, and I said, "Tell me what's wrong with this letter." And what it was, it said, 29 of my colleagues and I are writing in response to this FOIA denial, trying to appeal the decision. And what this was the House Judiciary Committee had written to the Pentagon through FOIA asking for documents, and the Pentagon had said no. And so they were appealing it. Like, what? And when you read FOIA, I'm not a lawyer, but we have lawyers here, and the FOIA law says, well, you're lawyers. If you look at the last sentence in the FOIA law, it says, this law will not be used to withhold information from Congress. It's supposed to be for us. It's not supposed to be for Congress. So that's the level that we're working with in the Congress. And so when it gets to questions of classification, it is amazing how, and Steve, we're, you know, collectively going up on the Hill along with our colleagues at GAP and other groups, trying to force the Congress to understand that they are supposed to be able to get this information. It's their job to be getting this information. Classified information is not supposed to be withheld from them, and it is such hard going. So they don't realize they need to get it.
Let me just interject that as much as sad as that story is, there is a certain element that's encouraging. I mean, in that it's the youngest staff in the history of the Congress.
Yes.
If you, you know, this is an Ernie Fitzgerald line, but he's Methodist and believes in the perfectibility of humankind. I mean, the fact that there is a training that can be done there and really coming in, because if you look at it even beyond the story that you've told on FOIA, on a lot of other things that have been going on, there isn't the background, and it is a place where you can get former members of Congress that used to do very, or staff, that used to do very heavy investigations and start to train in the way that that happened.
And that's and working really well.
In terms of prescriptive measure, I see that as a very hopeful place to go.
The questioner says something about Pearl Harbor. It just underscores what Mike German said, because Pearl Harbor was a case where we had broken the diplomatic code. We knew that there was no chance to settle this diplomatically. We sent out a warning to the Pearl Harbor and to the Philippines and several other bases in the east, warning them that an attack was imminent, it was top secret, imminent, and then, as a contradiction, saying not to alarm the local community.
Or the operational commander.
So we're at the lowest alert. There was a case where secrecy made us vulnerable, mm-hmm. and then more recently with the presidential daily briefing of August 6th, 2001, that Condi Rice says was historical. You know, here's a brief for the president saying that bin Laden wants to attack us here using airplanes, and they are doing some reconnaissance in New York City. That would have been much better if the White House didn't want to do anything, at least tell airlines and airports that there's something significant coming on. But there's another way of secrecy.
That I'm going to cut this off. We've had people over here really waiting to ask questions, and I want to get these two questions in, and maybe we can come back to it. Over here, please.
Hello. I'm Dr. Jeanette Parker. I am here with the Semmelweis Society International. We are a group of whistleblowing medical professionals and their supporters. And we are also on the front lines in regards to national security. When we live in an era where bioterrorist weapons are being used against us, and we are expecting our medical professionals to not only respond to terrorist attacks, but to secure select agents and to protect us with security measures regarding them, it is critical that we be able to allow our medical professionals to speak the truth. Our medical professionals, just like our national security whistleblowers who require their security clearances to do their jobs, our medical professionals require their doctor's license. The process by which doctors are stripped of their medical licenses when they come forward to whistleblow is basically a kangaroo court without true process. We have a process by which doctors are peer-reviewed in a secret session. That document is then sealed from discovery from even the doctor and the doctor's lawyer, the accused doctor's lawyer. And then the final decision is sent to a medical board for the final stripping of the doctor's license. And we call this process sham peer review. And I'm just wondering what our lawyers and other advocates would think we should do about correcting this process. Thank you.
Thank you. Someone want to take that? Stephen?
Yeah, I'm going to just generally address it. I think that when someone blows the whistle, they face retaliation in all forms. And it can be loss of a job, a security clearance. It could be a retaliatory investigation. It could be a peer review. The people that want to keep the information secret or retaliate will be creative in the mechanisms they use to stifle dissent. And so it's not surprising that within the medical profession they'll be utilizing peer reviews because it's an easy system. And I think that's the flip side. As we look at a legislative response to retaliation, that you need a system, a procedure, which does not permit those type of star chamber procedures to stifle dissent. And that's why when we have looked at it carefully, we're looking at the Title VII model, because it enables you to have a trial by jury as a fundamental right. And these trial by juries are already available to national security employees who complain about race or sex or national origin discrimination. So you can have a top secret clearance and raise an employment case and bring it to a jury today. Why not expand that right for whistleblowers, because the issues of retaliation tend to be similar. I also want to say one other thing, which is the response of the community itself. And this is to the response of sometimes where Congress does not do its job, where the press doesn't take things serious enough, or the community itself isn't as supportive. National security whistleblowers, like other whistleblowers, are a treasure. The information that they can bring to the public attention can save lives, can alter major events. You can look through history from Colin Raleigh's disclosures and the changes that occurred after that, Daniel Ellsberg's disclosures, but even in smaller cases, these whistleblowers are national treasures. And we need, as a legislative response, to have laws that will actually work, but I think as a community of supporters, to understand the difficulties, the individual difficulties they face on a daily basis, and to be supportive as aggressively as we can. And I think, be it a doctor or a FBI special agent, those problems are similar.
Thanks. Let's go over here.
Hi. My name is Luke Chesick. I just finished my second year of law school here. And my question is kind of, heard all this stuff today, and I'm sure to all these people in this room, it's not too shocking. It's kind of backing up the fears that we've had in our minds. But tonight, when I want to call my parents, who I'm from the Midwest, a small town, and I want to tell my dad about stuff I've heard, he's going to tell me, oh, you're a hippie liberal, you just go to schools out in D.C., and you don't know what you're talking about. And I don't really want to get in that argument now because I'm a little short of rent, so I need to find out. You know, I think that a lot of the change that we seek is not going to come until we get really political change in this country and until we vote the right people into office who really care about these issues. And someone like me who's trying to convince my parents to go in a certain political direction, how do I do that? kind of piggybacking on that, and I don't want a set answer. Maybe if you know people like this who you've been able to convince, kind of a follow-up question to that, and I don't know if this is too much, but where's the media? And why do my parents, why aren't my parents reading this on the news everywhere so that I don't have to yell at them?
I can start with this.
I might take that there. You know, the answer is educating yourself, because actually there is a lot of information out there. I mean, one of the things that was really frustrating for me in the run-up last summer to Protecting the Past or Protect America Act, which expanded FISA, and now we're going through it all again, was in May of 2007, 2 months before Congress voted to give the National Security Agency this unfettered power, Siobhan Gorman, of the Baltimore Sun, now with the Wall Street Journal, wrote an article about an internal NSA study that found that NSA management couldn't set goals nor meet them, and that NSA employees were unwilling to work with one another and didn't trust one another. They said that a similar study had been done 5 years before and had identified five major problems that needed to be fixed immediately. None of those problems had been addressed in the 5 years to the next meeting. That report literally was, that Baltimore Sun article was 2 months before Congress voted to give this agency more power. And literally the day after it passed, there was an article in Newsweek that said the NSA was suffering periodic electric failures, power failures, because their infrastructure was so antiquated. Now, those are problems with an agency that really need to be addressed. Giving that agency more power and less oversight doesn't make that agency more effective. It makes it less effective. And I think if you point out those things, I mean, as much as I criticize the Department of Justice IG, at least he puts a lot of facts out there. And I mean, if you just browse through the, dozen or so reports on the FBI's management in there. I mean, literally, the FBI was losing FISA wiretaps because they weren't paying their bills on time, because their financial management structure was so mismanaged. You know, these are serious problems that Congress can address tomorrow. You know, there's no great legislation that needs to be put in place. It just needs to be holding these people accountable. And that's why I think it's really more important for Congress to recognize its own power in this arena and to start making those changes right now.
One thing I could add on this is I don't think there's a single issue that's more nonpartisan than whistleblower protections, and that you could tell your Midwest conservative family that the king of protection of whistleblowers is Charles Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, and I mean, there's no one who comes close to him, I think, in the Congress, and it's really not a liberal issue at all. It's a love of country issue.
Right. I was going to add to that. I mean, you can have him read Scott McClellan's book. You can have him look at Mickey Edwards. I mean, there are a lot of non-hippies
that are critical.
Then they yell
at me because they're like, Richard Clark. Why didn't you do it when he's not getting paid for it? And
well, that's a different. That
I
is
never
a
get them.
No, and it's a dollar late. You know, day short, dollar late. We're going to move over here, take one more question, and then we're going to have to close. Sorry.
I think he was actually before we were. So.
Okay, please. Thank you.
My name is Mike Levin. Having spent a lifetime working to help enhance your national security, I feel as if I'm an endangered species here, but I think I'm safe. I'd like to make a couple of comments relating to what Danielle said on access to classified information or where you take it. In the Congress, the intelligence community considers that all elected representatives are cleared by dint of their election. They're cleared automatically. They are not automatically indoctrinated for sensitive compartmented information. That has to be done before sensitive compartmented information can be released to them. Where do you take classified information? If someone came to me and asked me, I would say, go to the Inspector General of the agency. But it sounds to me as if your view would be you can't trust the Inspector General of the agency, so you have to go someplace else. There are two places in the Congress where they have access and facilities to handle the highest classified information. And one is the SCIF, or Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, at HPSI, the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and the other is the SCIF at the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. They can handle all sorts of classified information. But to find a completely impartial organization that is charged with overseeing classified information, you want to go to the Information Security Oversight Office, which is in the National Archives, completely independent, authorized to see all sorts of information. And in addition, they have individuals assigned on oversight to each agency so that you can get a hold of the person of the agency that you're concerned with. These are the people that you should take information to. Finally, let me make one quick point about whistleblowing.
You know, I'm going to have to really ask that you be quick because we're 5 minutes
I'll
over
be very
already.
Quick. Just let me add that, sure. I would suggest that we very carefully advise whistleblowers. We like whistleblowers. Whistleblowers are good. They're absolutely necessary to all of us. But there is a line that if they cross, they're no longer whistleblowers. They're potential criminals, and that line is when they disclose validly classified national security information. They're no longer whistleblowers at that point. They have violated the law. Thank you.
Can Danielle, you want to do a quick response?
I'll do it very quick. I would never give a blanket denunciation of all IGs. I think that there are some that are much better than others. I think specifically the biggest issue actually has been with the military IGs, who are actually part of the military chain of command, and they are actually not independent. And in terms of members of Congress, the biggest problem is that staff often don't have that clearance, and a member of Congress by themselves is almost incapacitated if they have information, but their staff can't know about it and do anything with them. So that becomes, we've actually used those SCIFs but it's been almost worthless because of that reason. And then finally, with ISU, my sense is that they aren't charged with investigating misconduct. They just oversee classification policy.
Yeah. Kind of. If I just may, I'd just like to say that under the English Bill of Rights, the right to communicate to the Parliament was sacred. And those principles were incorporated into our Constitution even before the First Amendment was passed. It was well understood that Congress can't actually do its job if it's being denied vital information necessary to do its job. I think there's no need for a whistleblower to actually disclose truly classified information that's properly classified. I've never seen it in my life over the years. Who needs to know? It's not needed. But there's an overriding issue in these national security cases, which is the right of the people to petition Congress, which was recognized in the first federal whistleblower law for federal workers, Lloyd La Follette Act 1912, which gave all federal employees the right to communicate information to any member of Congress. And this is a tension that has been unresolved by the courts, but it's ultimately, I think, one of the most valuable pieces of weaponry in the hand of national security whistleblowers, because the day that our government or our courts come down and actually punish a whistleblower just for telling a member of Congress something, a matter of public concern, I think we then turn another page. And that's, I think, part of the issue that we're confronting.
Okay, thank you. You know, I really hate to cut off debate, particularly as interesting as it's been, and I feel horribly for you that have been standing over there waiting.
I can comment on his... I can tell you...
You know, I'm going to really, because I'm getting the axe from over here, I'm going to ask that you try and... people should engage one another kind of after the panel and have some discussions. I want to thank GAP. I want to thank AU for pulling this together. I want to thank all of the panelists for the lively discussion. And I do want to say that this is something that is heading into the headlines. I mean, if you look at the last week's habeas decision and you see what's going on in the presidential debates about how national security information is going to be or not going to be handled in the context of the defense, it is you can see the battle lines being drawn, and it is the timing of this is important. We need to stay on top of our game, and really I think that the work of so many of the organizations here are important. We need to do public education. We need to talk to this fellow's father in a way that that he can understand that these are important issues, and I think that this panel goes a long way towards helping us to that end. So thank you, everybody, and